Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Alami Podcast. We are live on LinkedIn, and this episode is special. I have with me here Ian Diskin, who is the president of Exact Excel Group Consulting, and you are the author and co-author of four books around change and people and all the softer aspect of organization, which actually are the critical aspect of organizations and for leaders to be able to drive high performance and create great workplaces. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Afud. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start from this, which is, I know that you've done this research and you've done a lot of work, and you worked also with other leading experts on driving transformation, driving improvement, driving change, and you kind of narrow it down to some key principles in order to move people forward, in order to mobilize people for improvement, for change, for transformation. What could you share with us, which could be practical for any manager or leader?
Well, let's begin maybe with some important basics. You know, this latest book that I'm the lead author of, The Secret Sauce for Leading Transformational Change, has some elements that come through, in essence, the secret sauce, as we put this book together. One of the most fundamental that we start with early in the book is this idea of start with truth, talent, and timing. And here's what I mean by that, because it applies to, I think, people at every level, both personally and organizationally. What do I mean by truth? Truth means define reality. The situation is what it is. We are where we are, and we have to face into the truth and reality of the circumstances that we're dealing with. One of the reasons why this may seem obvious, but it's so fundamentally important, is because there's all kinds of evidence over and over and over again when you're leading transformational change that a tremendous amount of energy gets wasted on denying the data or dismissing the facts that don't necessarily reinforce our preferred view of the internal or external environment. So if you're thinking about yourself as an individual, or you might lead a small team of people or even a larger group of people in a larger organization, just try to think about how many times people are sitting around discussing their different views on the facts and circumstances that the organization is facing. And usually there's some significant percentage of people who are just frankly in denial. Well, for every minute or hour that goes by, with people being in denial about the realities that they're facing, that's all time wasted in terms of getting traction on actually addressing the problem. So truth turns out to be fundamental. Second element is talent. What I mean by that is surround yourself with other people who can help you get the work done and help drive the kind of change that you know needs to happen. And this is true, by the way, on a personal level, by surrounding ourselves with friends and family and colleagues who we can learn from, who are going to help us be better and more effective and execute change. But it's certainly true at a team level or an organizational level as well, in terms of, you know, nothing difficult. And most things are difficult. Nothing difficult are we going to get done on our own by ourselves. And therefore, surrounding yourself with really good people who can help you execute matters a lot. And then this last point about timing, here's something that comes through loud and clear throughout this book that we put together. And that is that, generally speaking, in order to execute successful transformational change, you have to move faster than is generally comfortable. And in most cases, you know, if you go back and you talk to people on a personal level or on an organizational level and ask them to think about some big change that they've been through in their life or in their career, very rarely will somebody say, I wish I'd moved more slowly. Typically, people are saying, you know, I waited too long. I took too long to get started. I wasn't as aggressive as I should have been in order to achieve the kind of progress that I really needed to achieve. And therefore, this idea of timing really matters in the sense that you've got to move faster generally than feels comfortable in order to get the kind of progress that you're hoping to achieve and in living change and driving change. Those are maybe a few fundamental principles to get the conversation started.
It's interesting when I reflect on all the three, in a way, somehow they expose us as leaders and make us feel vulnerable in a way, right? So, I mean, the first one is the truth and the fact that, you know, when the truth is uncomfortable, we might feel exposed as leaders. Is like, okay, if the situation is bad, maybe it will tell indirectly that, you know, I'm not doing well, right? And this kind of maybe expose us. Maybe on the people side, on having like good people around it, I think, and I don't know if this is something in your research, is the idea of having complementary people, like not the same like us also, not only good people, but also people who complement us. Like if we are extroverted, maybe we need like some introverted. And usually what we do is we bring people like us and sometimes it doesn't help us. So, I mean, how does this connect to the insight that you get from the research?
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up because there's a couple of fundamental truths in what you said that also came through in the book. One is this idea of the vulnerability of people, whether they're in a leadership role or whether they're in an individual contributor role, the fear and anxiety that comes from being vulnerable, looking like you did a less than perfect job, that in fact leads to the need for the organization to change or for you as an individual to change. And I guess the simplest way I can say it is the vulnerability to allow yourself to recognize that either you're not perfect or your team is not perfect or your organization is not perfect is actually pretty essential to moving down the path successfully of making big change happen. By the way, it's interesting because most people worry about the fear and vulnerability of not changing, but quite typically the risk is much greater. The risk of failure in particular is much greater of not changing than making the changes that are essential. So, you know, human nature tends to get in the way. The point about human nature, that's the second point I wanted to make based on what you just said, is there are a number of paradoxes that have to be mastered, competing priorities, if you will. In the book, I call these things the beauty of and. You know, there's seven of them, but I'm sure we won't have time to discuss them all. But one specific example that relates directly to what we're talking about now is reconciling this competing priority between facts and feelings. So, you know, as we were just talking about a few minutes ago, you know, usually it's a set of facts and data that in theory should be telling us something important needs to change. However, human nature being what it is, human beings have this incredible capacity for denying and dismissing facts and data that don't reinforce their preferred view of the internal and external environment, like we were talking about a little while ago. And it's interesting because while the facts are so important in leading to change, because all of those changes are being implemented by people, feelings actually matter a lot more. You know, what's in your head, what's in your heart, how do you feel about what you're being asked to do? A perfect example of this, and I think most people can relate to, I talk about this in the book, is the idea of stepping on a scale and recognizing that you might need to lose some weight.
Yeah.
You know, the scale, the numbers on the scale are staring at you. The data is undeniable, you know, basically telling you that you should probably lose some weight. And most people are smart enough to know that it's a combination of diet and exercise that lead to successful weight loss. Mm-hmm. However, unless you are motivated as an individual, unless you have the feeling inside of you that you're willing to take the steps to diet and to exercise, you're not going to lose weight, no matter what the scale tells you. You know, the data is there. It's incontrovertible. It's telling you that you need to lose weight, but you must take action. And that action almost always comes from, how do you feel about what you're being faced with and what you're being asked to do? There are dozens and dozens of examples, not only in the book, but more importantly in life, that people run into as it pertains to this idea of reconciling facts and feelings in order to drive transformational change. So I really appreciate you asking.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, like once I had a professor from Harvard on the podcast, and he was sharing that, you know, in order to make group of people change, you cannot do it just with the mind. You need to do it with the heart. You know, you need to move them. And of course, the power is combining both. But usually what a lot of leaders would do is basically just, you know, rely on the mind and telling the facts. But in, like, moving to action, I mean, we all know, like, how to quit smoking and how to quit, like, you know, maybe bad habits. But we don't do it because it's more feelings attached to it in a way. So, but what are some other polarities or ends that you covered in your research?
Yeah, so another example of these polarities or competing priorities where you have to reconcile these ends would be speed and rhythm. So we were talking for a little bit earlier about move faster than generally feels comfortable. And in most successful transformational change, that's exactly what happens. You tend to find this great circumstance where the people who are leading change generally feel like it's moving too slowly. And the people who are the victims of, or the recipients of, the change most often feel like it's moving too fast, and they're generally uncomfortable as a result. However, you know, if you're the leader of your own team, or you're trying to bring other people along with you in the change, just moving faster by itself usually doesn't work, because you've got to bring these other people along with you. That requires a certain rhythm or cadence to what you're doing. I play a little bit of guitar, certainly not well enough to make a living at it. But I appreciate music and musicians. And one of the things you realize if you know anything at all about music is that in many ways, beautiful music is all about the harmonization and making sure everybody is on the same sheet of music and knows what their role is. And they're moving generally at the same speed or pace through the song. It's very rare that you would find a musician at any level of skill who would tell you that a song is enhanced by playing it faster and just getting to the end more quickly, right?
The
song is really enhanced by playing it at an appropriate pace and rhythm, and making sure everybody's on the same page. So speed without rhythm is basically noise. And speed and rhythm makes for beautiful music, but it also tends to make for successful transformational change. So that would be another example of an and that we're trying to reconcile.
Yeah. So you use a metaphor about pizza and change. So would tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, really jumped out at me as we were pulling the book together was the importance of understanding but not being put to sleep by tradition and things that have been, you know, in place for a really long time. So pizza, I think, is a good analogy. We call it a pizza analogy in the book, because if you go back and look at the history of pizza as a food and as an industry, it takes you all the way back to 997 AD in Gaeta, Italy, where pizza was thought to first be invented. And, you know, fast forward these many years later, you know, it's now about a $150 billion global industry. One of the things I learned in writing the book, you know, I mistakenly assumed that on a per capita basis, certainly the United States was the leader of the world in pizza. Well, it turns out that was wrong. On a per capita basis, the leading country for consumption of pizza in the world is Norway, which is not what I would have expected, frankly, although having visited there several times, I did notice there were a lot of pizza places sprinkled around. But think about it from the following perspective. If you look at things like shapes, sizes, toppings, cheeses, crusts, preparations, access outlets, and also the secret sauces that people tend to like to put on pizza, those elements of pizza have been evolving in enormous ways, all in response to a combination of external and internal factors and trends, in order for pizza as a food and as an industry to remain relevant and competitive. And so when you think about, you know, reimagining and reinventing in a lot of ways and repositioning pizza, there's a tremendously valuable analogy to what we have to do as human beings on an individual basis or with our teams or with our organizations to continually reinvent and reposition ourselves in order to remain relevant. And one of my favorite quotes that I picked up in, you know, taking a look at pizza as an analogy for leading transformational change, basically says, believe in yourself. If cauliflower can become pizza, you can become anything. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, the whole trend toward cauliflower crust, as an example, I'm a pizza traditionalist, so I'm not much for cauliflower crusts or certain ingredients on pizza, which I see as a little bit too far away from tradition. But, you know, look around the world. People are doing whatever they're doing with pizza because pizza is no longer pizza, and individuals are no longer individuals, and teams are no longer teams, and organizations are no longer organizations. And this has huge implications for societies as well that are going through these huge transformational changes, and you have to let go of certain traditions which no longer apply in order to remain relevant and compete for the future. That was one of the biggest lessons that I picked up, frankly, from being the lead author of this book.
So if we when we talk about like moving fast for change and the truth and recognizing the truth, it reminds me of this one quote by Jack Welch, where he says, change before you have to. And so in a way, basically what you found is something that it's a common mistake that, you know, between not acknowledging the new reality one on one side and maybe going slow, this is what a lot of leaders fall into. Is this the case?
Yeah, very much so. And to build on what you were just saying, one of the things that really jumped out at me in writing this book was there seems to be this general belief that successful change, as you said, you know, change before you have to, which goes along with the idea that you somehow need to anticipate and prepare for change, see around corners, you know, earlier than most people would, And if you're able to do that in a very anticipatory way, somehow change is therefore more strategic and successful. And there are plenty of examples, not only in the book, but in life, of this anticipatory kind of change. And so I'm not dismissing the importance of that at all. However, it turns out there's a bit of a misconception here, because most change comes from circumstances that are unanticipated, unplanned for. We were unprepared. And it's really about, you know, how quickly and effectively do you respond? You know, we're actually living through a perfect example of that right now, which is, you know, 2 years plus into the COVID-19 pandemic that's affecting people all over the world. Well, you know, most people, especially me, were not smart enough to see COVID-19 coming. Yeah. However, you know, all of us as individual human beings, as well as people, you know, part of organizations, have had to figure out how to respond. One of my favorite quotes that I think really speaks to this directly is from Mike Tyson, who, you know, was the heavyweight boxer. And he was being interviewed by a member of the media in advance of one of his heavyweight bouts, who was asking him what his strategy was, you know, for the fight. And he said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And it turns out that that's true for, you know, all of us and the organizations that we're part of. We're getting punched in the mouth all the time. So we have a plan and we think we know what we're going to do. But then somebody hits us and we have to figure out how to adapt and be flexible. And this whole agility idea is central to all of that. You know, Jack Welch also said, you know, if the speed of change outside is greater than the speed of change inside, you're basically dead, right? And, you know, whether or not you happen to be a fan of Jack Welch, I think there's a lot of truth to that. So understanding what's happening around us, particularly externally in things that we do not control, but which heavily affect our ability to be successful and happy, you got to pay attention to those things, because usually the biggest disruptions come from places that you least expected those disruptions to come from. Yeah. And that's why we often get surprised.
Yeah. I think this idea of the people being resistant to the change, or like being slow in the process, I'm just kind of want to reflect on my own journey, being at the beginning of my career, being leading a team and doing something which is I wasn't maybe that passionate about, and maybe I didn't believe in that much. And then later on moving into something which was I was super passionate about, and it was extremely meaningful to me. And I found that actually, if, you know, applying what we're talking about here, you know, adapting to the change or driving people forward, driving higher performance, transforming what I'm doing or what my team is doing, it was coming naturally when it was so meaningful to me, like what work I'm doing, right? And I think here it's somehow it takes us back to this idea of purpose. And it's like, I'm not sure if Nietzsche said this, which is the one who has a big why can figure out anyhow. And so when you have a purpose, in a way, you will find a vehicle, you will find an approach. But if you don't have a why, maybe you will find excuses. Maybe you will find the obstacles. Maybe you will find, and I don't know, I'm just a question to you, like, do you think the fact or the way that organizations are built and managers getting promoted and leaders, is this leading us to this place, which is, you know, like a lot of leaders and managers are in places which maybe they don't believe in or they're not passionate about, and that's why maybe they are slow in terms of pushing and striving for excellence and driving higher performance and, again, predicting change or, like, at least being fast to drive it?
One of the things we know for sure on a global basis is that engagement is pretty low. You know, when you talk about engagement scores, you know, of 20%, you know, of people really being engaged and committed to their job and their career, or 30%, that's nothing to brag about. And so I think we got a huge job to do as individual people, but also as leaders of teams and others in the organizations that we're part of, to create a sense of purpose. And increasingly, what's very obvious to me, not only in writing this book, but just in my experience as a coach and a consultant, is that the idea of purpose starts at the individual level, not at the organizational level. What I mean by that is companies spend a lot of time and effort trying to talk about vision and mission and values, and they should. However, most individuals, when they're deciding whether they want to be part of your organization and whether they want to stay with you, are evaluating things from their personal sense of purpose. You know, what's important to me at the individual level, and is what this organization is all about compatible with that? And so if you translate all that into, you know, how do I lead change in an organization, you actually have to start with the individual, not with the organization, which I think for some people seems backwards. But for me, it's very clear. Not that I'm so smart. I just have seen over and over and over again mistakes made where the organization puts a lot of effort and energy into articulating the why and the how, but the why and the how are almost always communicated from the perspective of the company, you know, or the organization's needs. And while that matters, you actually have to start with what's important for the why and the how to the individual, because all large-scale transformational change, in my humble experience, begins with the individual. You know, and one of the elements of the secret sauce that we talk about in the book is this idea of define, align, and refine the what and why. And you do have to put a lot of effort and energy into talking about the vision and the mission and making it clear and all that. But you actually have to spend as much or more time listening and understanding from the individual perspective what's important to me as a contributing member of the team or the organization. The leaders who do that well, who listen and allow themselves to be influenced heavily by what they're hearing from the people who work with and for them, are almost always going to be much more effective at leading transformational change and making it stick, you know, making it last longer, than leaders who are simply telling people, you know, why we need to change and what needs to be done and how you can contribute to the change, but spending no time listening to what the individual needs and expects.
Yeah, this is great. So let's take a practical example. Let's say I'm a team leader of, I mean, it could be, let's say, five people, right? And I'm coming up with, I'm saying, look, we need to kind of improve our customer service, and that's why we are introducing maybe a new system and process and maybe like KPIs, right? And of course, I mean, a lot of people would be like, okay, well, why it's already working right now, right? So so from the organization perspective, I could say, well, this is important for the company because the customer retention, because some of our competitors are taking some share, because the future is like this, that, that. Right, okay, good. But from the people side, now, okay, what's in it for me in a way? And what's in it for me, it doesn't have to be like financially, but overall as a human being, you know, why should I do that? And so, I mean, so tell me like your perspective, because I always think about it this way, which is, okay, even if I put about the organization, why it's important, I need to explain it very clearly for the individual, for my team members, or for my you know, workforce, why, what's in it for them in a way? So, I mean, how would you approach it if we take this practical example?
Well, if we just use the example you just gave, the first place I would begin is with the question, what is making it more difficult for you to get your job done effectively? Because that usually will tell you all you need to know about what the impact is on the customer or the client or the recipient of the product or service, because I, the deliverer of those services or products, am highly frustrated because there's all these issues and problems and obstacles that are getting in my way of doing a good job and feeling fulfilled and delivering the end product or service to a customer and keeping them happy. That's the way I would tend to think about approaching it, which, by the way, you know, going back to what we were just talking about, starts with listening. You know, it starts with a question. It doesn't start with, you know, let me tell you why our organization is screwed up and we're not doing a good job and here's how we're going to fix it. It starts with the question that is really based in you and your own personal effectiveness. One of the reasons why this is so important to me, I'm a believer, you know, when you write a book, which is a fun and interesting experience in a variety of ways, hopefully you're teaching people something. But I also believe that you should be learning something, when you write a book. And I learned a number of things about leading transformational change. They were kind of ahas for me, one of which is directly related to what we're talking about now. And that is, if you read a lot of books on change, one thing that you will always see is this great debate. Is it really true that people hate change, or do they actually like and embrace change? And a lot of different opinions on this topic. I'll tell you where I came down on it as a result of writing this book. I actually do think people hate change. However, I think they hate failure even more. So if you can put things in the context of, you know, why we might be failing together, not why you are failing, but why we collectively might be failing or underperforming or not serving the customer in a way that the customer deserves to be served. But if we change some things, we can win and we can be successful and we can ensure that we don't fail. That's energizing to people. Just saying to people, we need to change, and you need to change, and you need to do things better in an abstract way, isn't energizing to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And therefore,
absolutely.
I think you got to pay attention to, you know, how do we appeal to people's hatred of failure, which actually exceeds their hatred of change.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, like, I like to connect this to this need for significance in a way, right? So failure, in a way, it touches on or make people feel insignificant. And that's why leveraging this, it's powerful. I like what you said, but starting by asking them, starting by engaging them. But what I found also is that sometimes even if you have a solution in mind, and you really think that it's the best way to go about it, involving them is basically, it could be coming up with a solution, but it could be even like discussing the solution and what could be the obstacles and, you know, how we can ensure that it works. So it's also powerful. So basically you still have you can involve people early, but you can also involve them maybe, you know, if you are in a situation where you have something which could be the most effective, you can still involve them in refining it, designing it or implementing it. And in a way, somehow it's not ideal as involving them earlier, but somehow it worked. But this idea of engaging people, involving people in the process is so important. What would you say?
Yes, in a huge number of ways, you know, starting with the fact, this would be another aha for me in putting the book together, that, you know, leaders matter in driving change. However, leadership matters more. What I mean by that is, you know, anybody, no matter what job they're in, no matter what their job title is or isn't, no matter what level of the organization they happen to sit in, can actually play a leadership role in helping to define the need for and executing on change and providing good ideas for what could be done differently and better. You don't necessarily have to have a job title that defines you as a leader. And I like to say, when leading transformational change, ignore the organization chart to a degree, because I think there's a natural tendency for a lot of organizations to say, you know, it's the leaders at the top who are going to define and drive change and basically communicate to everyone else the need for change and expect them to implement and execute. That's actually a fallacy. It's really not a successful strategy. What's much more successful repeatedly is to identify people at any level of the organization, make them engaged in the change effort, educate them as to what the needs are, and mostly listen to them because they're a lot closer to the customer or to the problems that are being addressed through a change effort, and cause them to feel heard and influential and valuable in contributing to the change. That becomes very energizing. If your whole approach to change is hierarchical and you only start with the people at the top and expect them to communicate to people who work for them, and that's the only approach you use, that's generally not sufficient, and it kind of undermines your effort to energize and engage people in leading transformational change. In order to lead transformational change, you do not have to be in a leadership role. You just need to behave in a way that's consistent with leadership, no matter where you sit in the organization.
Yeah, and in a way, it's like activating all the resources and the talents within the organization to get you moving and create momentum in moving forward. But just to tell you, like, again, going back to this idea of focusing also on the individuals, I like to think about it or look at it in this perspective, which is, it's the and, right? So it's, I'm looking at the like the polarity that we were talking about. It's one of them is the organization needs and the people needs. And as leadership and as leaders, we marry these two together and we make it very clear, like, for, you know, like how it will both go hand in hand. And for me, when I look at the people, especially if I have a group of people, because in a way, the human needs, they change per person. Some people, they have the need to grow and to move up in the organization. It's number one. And some other people, actually, safety and security for the long term, this is the number one, right? Some people, actually, they like challenge. They like new projects and new, and maybe being involved in different kind of customers. But as a leader, I mean, if I don't have time to sit with everyone, which if you are like up in the organization, actually you don't, I need to kind of connect to all this need at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's why for me, for example, when I was driving some of this change programs, I was like, you know what? If you go back to this customer service example, I would say, look, you know, driving improvement in this, it will create for all of us safety and security for the future. You know, we will all be here because we took an initiative, we took a step. You know, we will not only sustain our jobs, but actually will create even more jobs, right? So and basically the need for significance is say, look, I mean, we want to be special, we want to be like the first. you know, within the organization or within the industry to take this step, right? And maybe the need for growth, like to grow, to improve, everyone has this need. Say, you know what, like we will develop certain skills which will be key for us in the future. So we can be the leaders, you know, so we can, we will grow all of us by going there. And the need for connection and belonging is like, we will do it together. We will help each other. We will be there for each other. It will be challenging, but we will be there for each other. And so basically these are like some of the needs, and highlighting this and explaining it, because as I'm speaking about it, you know, with a group of people, I'm connecting to few of them because these are the top needs for them, right? What do you think about this?
Well, what you're also speaking to directly, I agree with everything that you've said, is the value of diversity and inclusion in the culture that you're building and in the team that you're building. Why do I say that? Because, you know, each person who you work with, whether you have three people working for you or 3,000 people working for you, has a different lens through which they see the problem. They have different and unique needs and desires for what they're trying to get out of the organization and their work life. You know, in some cases, it's a high need for security and stability. In other cases, it's career progression. In other cases, it's to make more money. In other cases, it's to have a higher degree of influence over the direction that the organization is taking. And while these needs can all be reinforced in a number of ways, you can't appeal equally to each person's need. But what I think you can do is create the environment in what you do as a leader to cause people to feel valued and heard and have an opportunity to contribute their perspective, even though they might do it in different ways. And, you know, one of the things that really became important for me as we were putting this book together that speaks to this is the recognition that one of the worst things that you can do as a leader, even if you have a few people working for you and not hundreds, is to make people feel stupid or disloyal if they push back on the change that is being asked of them or ask tough or difficult questions. I think sometimes we as leaders feel like we're being successful if everybody just salutes and agrees with the change and lines up around it and tells us as the boss, you know, yes, boss, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, we need to do this, even if they don't believe it. And leaders tend to be offended by, to some degree, people who push back or resist. And I have found that the change effort is usually much more effective if you create an environment where you welcome some degree of debate and discussion and asking difficult questions, and, you know, somebody's pushing back, maybe not because they just hate change, but because they want to make sure that the organization is focused on the right things. If you as a leader can create that type of open, transparent, collaborative, debate-oriented environment, you're going to end up with a much better approach to driving change than if you simply tell everybody, you know, this is the way it's going to be, and I expect you all to fall in line and comply with my commands, and everybody is, you know, scared out of their minds to push back. And usually some big mistakes get made because there hasn't been enough diversity of thought put into the approach. So I'm a firm believer in surround yourself with a team of people who are different than you in terms of experience and culture, the way they think, how they solve problems, the kind of educational backgrounds and functional backgrounds that they might have. And then don't waste all that talent by failing to listen to them. Actually ask them what they think and listen. It doesn't mean you have to agree with everything or do everything that everyone suggests, but creating an environment where you're willing to take the time to listen will tend to energize people much more than simply telling them what to do and expecting them to comply, which very rarely happens, frankly.
And this takes us again to this first point that you highlighted, which is exposing the truth, right? And because at the end of the day, you as a leader, it's very difficult for you to see the whole picture, and you need this input from across, and empowering people to share their perspectives, it makes a big difference in a way.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And you know, I would say to anybody who's listening or watching, you know, I don't think either one of us is naive. I mean, there are good leaders out there and there are bad leaders out there. And some of you may be working for people who don't listen, don't want to listen, don't care, think they have all the answers. That can be, you know, extremely difficult and not as enriching as working for somebody who's, you know, a much more effective leader who's willing to be influenced. But even with the most difficult boss or working in the most difficult organization that doesn't necessarily, you know, want to change or know how to change, you can actually have a very substantial, significant personal influence over improving the effectiveness of the organization if you have the courage and the willingness to periodically, you know, raise your head up just enough to say, you know, I notice in working with my customers or my clients or my colleagues, the following thing is really not working as effectively as we all want it to. And if we would just be willing to make this adjustment, it would make a huge difference. You might be surprised. People might actually appreciate your willingness to help support that type of improvement.
That's great. So, Ian, for closing, what's one piece of advice you would like to share with all leaders out there?
Well, one of the best pieces of advice, I think actually the best piece of advice I've ever received in my career was somebody I used to work with and consider a mentor, who said, find a void and fill it. You know, most organizations have all kinds of things going on that are unaddressed or no one's paying attention to, or it's a problem that's existed for, you know, 20 years that everybody talks about and complains about and worries about, but nobody steps up to address it or fix it. Nobody thinks it's their job, perhaps, or they're just too busy. And so if you're looking for a way to distinguish yourself, find something in the organization that is unaddressed or a constant irritant to a lot of people. And whether it's part of your job description or not, figure out a way to step in, help fix it. And you may be amazed at, you know, people's gratitude for your willingness to do that. But also, all of a sudden, you get a reputation as being a person who can solve problems. And that is a characterization of you as a person and as a leader, I think, that will serve you well in life and career. And that's why I found it to be such a helpful piece of advice.
I think it's great that you are sharing it here toward the end, because I have this slogan, which actually a title of my upcoming book called Change Your Company or Change Your Company. And the idea is exactly what you're saying, which is, look, I mean, be a driver, be a creator, add value, and actually find challenge within the organization or your team or the partner and solve it, or at least take initiative to solve it. And if you are not willing to do so, ask yourself this question, why? Because it might be actually that your values are not aligned with the value of this workplace, right? Or, you know, you are not doing what you're supposed to be doing and you would like to be somewhere else. So in that case, change your company, you know, go somewhere else. And so to be able to do something like this, to do something, to do great work, to make a difference. And the reason is that the fulfillment you will get from doing something like this, to be a driver, to be a creator, this is priceless.
I love that philosophy because like you, I think a firm believer in the value of controlling your own destiny and ultimately your own happiness and fulfillment. You know, your organization or your spouse or your friends or other family members aren't going to make you happy or fulfilled. Only you are. You know, they contribute to it. But if you don't surround yourself with the right people, both personally and professionally, it's extremely difficult to feel fulfilled and engaged and energized and that you're making a difference. It's actually one of the most important reasons why we wrote the book, because the whole idea of leading transformational change is really all about taking control over the environment that you're in and the organization that you're in, and not just letting things happen to you. You're actually understanding what's going on around you and making the adjustments, big and small, that you have to make in order to create an environment of greater effectiveness or happiness or health or even survival. You know, that's what leading transformational change is. And it's all about, you know, starting with, you know, you, the individual, how you take control of that.
Yeah. And, you know, just to close here, I remember like I had one senior leader in one of the programs I was running, and he came to me after when I was telling him about like this idea of driving change. He told me, you know, I found like one is very inspiring leader. And I went there and I asked him like, why are you like driving like this and taking, and he looked at him and he said, because it's more fun. It's more fun to be a driver, you know. It's like it's more fun than being a complainer, or you know, like, and this was for me. I was like, that's true.
You know? Oh, it's so true. I mean, I consider myself to be an extraordinarily lucky person. You know, I've worked in a career now, you know, over 40 years, and have loved what I've done. Doesn't mean, you know, I've loved every minute. Doesn't mean I've loved every single person that I've worked with. But when I look back collectively, you know, over the 40 years that I've spent, both my corporate career and my more entrepreneurial coaching and consulting life, I've really loved what I've done. And I spend a lot of time around other people who don't love what they do. And the day is a lot longer and life feels a lot shorter. If you don't love what you do. So, you know, what I would encourage anybody who's, you know, listening and watching is, you know, really be honest with yourself. Are you loving what you're doing? Chances are while, you'll make some good positive change happen in the environment around you, and you should. Mostly the change that you're seeking starts with, you know, you as the person, understanding what's high priority for you, what your needs are, what's important to you, what you value, what's your sense of purpose. And if the place that you're at doesn't align with that, go do something else, because life is too short not to be loving what you're doing.
Absolutely. I think this is a great ending for our session today. Thank you so much, Ian, for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And thank you to all the people who will be listening to this episode. As always, stay inspired and make the biggest difference you could make within your area of responsibility and beyond it. Until the next time. Bye.